This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Losing a job can be an opportunity, especially for retail and restaurant workers who are the main targets of layoffs right now in Bloomington Normal.
There's hope after a layoff. They can work when they're going to school as well.
Donna Nanny, a business service representative and trades planner at CareerLink in Normal, says there are 900 fewer retail jobs than last year in Bloomington Normal. Plus, the history of Sibley, Illinois includes once being the center of perhaps the nation's largest farm. John Norton gives us the music of Cracker. Theater leads to lasting love, a Next to Normal Story Slam story with correspondent Brianna Groh. And deciding when to try to save and when to cut down a long-established tree in your yard during GLT's Grow. All that and a GLT News update on the way. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from GLT listeners. Join the community of news consumers who listen to Sound Ideas and are also willing to support it financially. Learn more about listener-supported radio and GLT at WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Last week on Sound Ideas, you heard about wages in McLean County rising slower than they are statewide and across the country. Today, GLT's Ryan Denham approaches the issue from a new perspective, talking to those on the front lines when low-wage workers get laid off or try to launch a new career.
4 years ago, the big story in the Bloomington Normal economy was the closure of Mitsubishi's manufacturing plant and the loss of 1,200 jobs. Some workers got retrained and found new jobs. Others left the area forever. Today, it's retail and restaurant workers who are being displaced most often, and they're facing an equally tough choice. Find another quick but fragile low-wage job or get retrained for a stable, better-paying career. Employment experts like Donna Nanny say those that go back to school are finding success in high-demand fields such as CDL driver and healthcare.
And they've been in retail, and I hear this, that, you know, this is the fourth time I've been laid off in a retail situation.
Nanny is a business service representative and trades career planner at the CareerLink office in Normal.
I hear this all the time, that these individuals at one time, maybe they wanted to go back to school, but they missed it. Well, now they have this opportunity, and they can go back to school.
WGLT regularly does stories on the monthly unemployment rate, real estate sales, economic indices, and other statistical readouts of the Bloomington Normal economy. But CareerLink is on the front lines. The federally funded CareerLink office at 705 East Lincoln Street in Normal helps job seekers with resumes, interviewing, and other one-on-one assistance. But its bread and butter is retraining, connecting workers with the money and other guidance they need to make a career change. Office manager and senior career planner Shelley Purchase says workers can get up to $22,000 in tuition and fees for retraining, plus potential help with required books, uniforms, and even mileage assistance.
There may also be some assistance available for childcare as well if they're needing some help paying for that childcare while they are attending school. Pretty much anything that's required for the program we can look at and try to help them out with.
Workers are finding success retraining as CDL drivers and healthcare professionals. That's according to Kelly Schattmeyer, program manager at CareerLink. She says there's a shortage of CDL drivers.
Usually it's only a four-week program, so they can go through their training in 4 weeks and then get a job right away. And so they're not without that income for very long.
She says low-income clients are encouraged to use retraining money to become registered nurses or licensed practical nurses.
So there's lots of opportunity for them to grow and continue to grow in that field.
The Bloomington Normal area's unemployment rate fell to 3.3% in May. That's the lowest of any metro area in Illinois. But retail jobs here are getting harder and harder to come by. The Illinois Department of Employment Security says there were 9,100 retail positions in Bloomington Normal in May. That's 900 fewer retail jobs than there were just 5 years ago. When retail stores close, CareerLink often responds. Donna Nanny says they sent a rapid response team to Dress Barn in Normal after the women's clothing chain announced in May that all 650 of its stores would be closing. They answer questions about unemployment benefits, insurance options, and, of course, retraining opportunities. Sometimes it's hard for people to see losing a job as an opportunity.
I talk and I give examples of individuals that have come through our doors. Our career planner will give examples of, you know, this individual came through and it was a single mom or a single dad, and now what can they do to go on with their life after a layoff? There's hope after a layoff. And so some will say, well, how am I going to live? And there's opportunities that they can work when they're going to school as well. There's funding opportunities through the school. You know, there could be scholarships that they're eligible for and so on.
Retraining is also a way to escape McLean County's relatively slow wage growth. WGLT reported last week that local wages are rising slower than the state and national averages, including in the key financial services, retail, and leisure and hospitality sectors. Senior career planner Shelley Purchase says they see a lot of minimum wage jobs and jobs capping out at around $10 an hour.
A lot of people that are getting laid off, and they might have been making way more than that, they're trying to go into another field and another job, and they're finding out they can only find something for $10 an hour, and that's way less than what they were making before. And so we definitely see a lot of frustration from people with that, which is why our training services are really important, because that's helping someone reach a higher wage by having more skills.
Donna Nanny says even some entry-level manufacturing jobs aren't paying what CareerLink considers the self-sufficient wage for a single person, about $11.66 an hour. Nanny is the one who works closely with businesses, finding out what they need from the workforce. On a practical level, she says CNC machining skills are in high demand, but she says soft skills are wanted too, and soft is showing up for work.
You can train somebody, but if they're not coming to work, if they're not getting along with their supervisor, their coworkers, most likely that's why they lose their job. Not because they can't do the job, but because they do not have those soft skills, those interpersonal skills to retain that employment.
That's CareerLink Business Service Representative Donna Nanny, interviewed yesterday with her CareerLink colleagues Kelly Schapmeyer, Shelley Purchase, and Dina Weth. I'm Ryan Denham.
You can learn more about CareerLink's services on its website, CareerLink16.com.
GLT is made possible by Illinois State University, home of the Illinois State Redbirds. Featuring 19 teams competing at the NCAA Division I level, Illinois State promotes success in the athletic and academic arenas. News, schedules, and ticket information can be found at goredbirds.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Still to come, GLTs grow and how to decide whether to cut down that beloved tree. Small towns all over Illinois are preparing for the 4th of July holiday, celebrating the nation's origins and sometimes their own. Today we'll look at one of those communities, Sibley, Illinois, east of Bloomington Normal, over by Gibson City. Marge Vetter is a member of the Sibley Business and Historical Association. Her family has more than a century of history and involvement in Sibley. Vetter says Sibley was at one time the center of perhaps the nation's largest farm.
It first originated from a gentleman by the name of Michael Sullivan. He bought a grave amount of farmland in 1854, and it comprised of 65 square miles and 40,000 acres. He lost about 20,000 acres in the Broadland area, which is south of Champaign, and he sold it for over $250,000 back then.
So who was he?
Michael Sullivan. He was just a big landowner. He came from Ohio. His name is Michael Sullivan. But then, after a while, he was having a lot of problems with his money, and he and Mr. Sibley bought it in 1878, I believe.
Who was Sibley?
Mr. Sibley was Hiram Sibley. He was from Chicago. He lived in Chicago, but is originally from Rochester, New York. And he came to this area to buy land, and he bought the land from Mr. Sullivan and created a vast amount of a tenant system, most like sharecropping or whatever, but he was a very great agricultural person, created many new agriculturals, like devices. He had his own farm machinery he created. He created a lot of the lambs with the tenant systems, the tenant houses, and he also was a creator of Western Union, the telegraph system.
So that's kind of where some of that money came from.
Yes, and at the time he created these tenant houses and farms, he painted all the houses yellow to commemorate his ownership of Western Union, and also everyone got a red barn. He supplied 4 horses and 3 milk cows on each farm.
How
it all started, and then he started building houses and seed barns and churches and grocery stores and things in the Sibley area.
So how dependent were the tenant farmers on him? How were the leasing arrangements? Were they tough? Did they give the ability for the tenant farmers to make a decent living, or how was it?
Oh, yes. Yes, he did. He was a very generous man. He hired a farm manager to look over the farms and help him. It was sort of an innovation by some of the sister-in-laws of the Sibley family that in the 1930s, every house received electricity in the farms and also bathrooms. So everyone was treated the same. Everyone was given the same amenities by the Sibley family back then. He also created the idea of the livestock management and brought in the idea of hog farms and cattle, and they're all purebreds. So he set up hog buildings, cattle buildings, and everything in order to help supply the farmers with extra income besides the agriculture of corn and soybeans.
How long did the land ownership stay concentrated in that family? You mentioned a couple of Sibley heirs.
This is very interesting because my husband and I left the Sibley farm, which was painted yellow, to one of the was a Sibley heir, and that was in 2006. It lasted up until the family in 1977. It was divided among some heirs, and all the farms were put in a hat, and they drew numbers. So every farm had a different number. And then, as presently, right now, as of this year, there is one farm left that is owned by a Sibley heir. And that's just 3 miles west on 165 in Sibley.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. We're talking with Marge Vetter. We often think of the origin of hybrid seed as belonging to Tazewell County with the yellow dent corn. But you're saying that Hiram Sibley was also a seed experimenter and agricultural entrepreneur in research areas as well.
Yes, he was. One of the neat things that I found out was the Sibleys had a seed house. And all the seeds were created in Rochester, New York, or in the Chicago area, and supplied to the farmers here in Sibley. One of the things that my husband and I found out that many of the seeds and the seed boxes they were displayed in, you can see them at the Henry Ford Museum at Greenfield Village in Dearborn, Michigan. The general store has a display of all this. And still on today, you can find Sibley seed advertisement and seed packages that are sold on eBay, even the seed boxes. My husband and I had went to a meeting over in Funk's Grove by Bloomington and had also listened to a lecture by a gentleman, and he was also a good friend of Mr. Funk, creator of Funk's Grove.
And Funk Seeds, so.
Yes. So I'm sure that there was some correlation between the two, and he did create his own seed.
When did Sibley Seed go out of business?
I'm not too sure. He had already had his companies in Rochester, New York, established There is a huge, huge museum in Rochester, New York, where his home is still standing. And the library is a huge area just devoted to the Sibley family.
How important is this family legacy to pass on to residents today? Is it largely forgotten other than by history buffs like you?
Pretty much, although I think a lot of people have known about the Sibley family. Tom Sibley at one time lived in Sibley. He just passed away in 2006, but he resided here for a while. And so people know he had brought some buffalo here to Sibley at one time. But people knew Tom Sibley, and they sort of knew of the legacy of the Sibley family. But as time goes on now, yes, it's not as relevant to the newcomers in town. But we as a Sibley Business and Historical Association just want to keep the legacy alive.
How large was the average farm size?
They ranged from anywhere from 80 acres to 160 acres when it first started.
So if he owned 20,000 acres around Sibley, that's a lot of farmers.
Yes. I think if my memory is correct, he established about 146 farms out of those acres. By a certain date, he had built over 134 houses. Not only did he have a house for his tenants, he also built houses, at least one or two houses, for the laborers that helped the tenant.
And that was a little unusual because they often lived in sheds or an outbuilding.
Right. Even when my husband and I lived on this one of the Sibley Air Farms, we had two houses also that were let us provide for two laborer families to live in.
Now, did he take a similar collective approach to harvest, or was that dependent on the tenant farmers themselves to make those arrangements?
He left it to the farm manager to do what he thought was correct. All farming was based on a 50-50, 50% income, 50% expenses were all done by the farmer and the landlord. That included also when raising livestock, that was all 50-50 done. And also when it came to do any improvements to the insides of the buildings, that was also handled 50-50. So when a farmer got ready to retire or quit, he is reimbursed his 50% share of what he put into the buildings.
How vibrant is Sibley today? A lot of rural communities are struggling with the hollowing out of the rural population. How vibrant is Sibley?
Well, around Sibley, the farms are getting larger and larger. Many of the small farms, the houses are gone, torn down, tool sheds are torn down, and just made into very large farms. The town itself, at one time it was larger, now it's, I believe it's down to 300 people. Of course, our post office used to be open full-time. Now it's only open 5 hours during the day to eventually, I'm sure that our post office will be closed with only little boxes to get our mail. A lot of the businesses have closed, although in Sibley we do have three very nice gift shops. Last year, we totally renovated our downtown, all based on donated money, with all new sidewalks, all new face buildings painted. We had the original street lamps refurnished along the main street. You can tell that a lot of people still like Sibley, and a lot of the money was not from the local people itself. Some of it was, but a lot of it was from people that grew up here and just really wanted to see Sibley come alive.
Marge Vetter is with the Sibley Business and Historical Association talking about the village today and its founder, Hiram Sibley. Sibley will celebrate its origins this weekend with car shows, two musical concerts, and History of Sibley tram tours. Find out more about the Sibley Business and Historical Association at its Facebook page.
What makes a sin deadly?
Envy, I think, is my favorite sin. There's something so imaginative about it.
Pride leads to a lot of problems.
Greed is being a sociopath.
But with lust, who doesn't feel lust for life? And how can we tell someone not to feel lust?
I'm Guy Raz. The 7 Deadly Sins. That's next time on the TED Radio Hour from NPR.
Sundays at 10 a.m. on GLT. News and ideas.
Support for GLT comes from CEFQ, partnering with car dealers throughout central Illinois to make the auto loan process quick and convenient. Competitive rates for qualified buyers. Online pre-approval is available. CEFQ, not a bank, better. Details at CEFQ.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Still to come, a love story from a Bloomington Normal Story Slam. It's hard to remember a long-standing tree in your landscape that has been inhabitant. It's hard to remove such a tree when it's been an inhabitant for decades. It's also hard to know how far to go to try to save it and how to reach the decision to remove it. ISU's Patrick Murphy talks with GLT's Mike McCurdy about an effort to save a honey locust and provides some answers to know when enough is enough.
To what lengths should you go to save a tree? When is a Herculean effort appropriate, and when is it time to just throw in the towel? I'm Mike McCurdy. This is GLT's Grow, your source for practical gardening advice from our expert, Patrick Murphy, from Illinois State University School of Biological Sciences and curator of the Fell Arboretum. Patrick, thanks for stopping by.
Thanks for
another
edition
of Grow. So you have an epic story about a honey locust tree. First, what is a honey locust? What's it look like? Compound leaves, right?
Yes, that's right. Honey locust is here in central Illinois and most of the Midwest. It's a native tree. And it has a umbrella type shape. It's a large tree, so it'd be a extra large in the scale of shade trees in our world. And it has this leaf that shows up very late in the spring, and then it drops early in the fall. And there are many, many cultivars of this tree, because they were really popular at one time in the past.
So this started as a question for you from Holly, really seeking advice about whether to continue to invest time and money into this tree or simply remove it. The problems became apparent when a large section of bark popped off near the base of the tree.
So Holly was able to share photos of the tree's conditions, and there was in the photos evidence of the crown thinning, internal decay in the tree that was basically isolated near a structural defect right at the ground. The leaves that were on the tree were discolored, and you could even tell by zooming in that some of those leaves were malformed. And I also noticed that there were a lot of leaves on the ground, more so than would be, say, typical after a rain shower or a wind event.
That gives you sort of a baseline as to the health of the tree. It just can't hang on to healthy leaves.
That's a good way of putting it, Mike, because they're poorly attached because the tree's having some issues.
Her first indication was this large chunk of bark that popped off near the base of the tree, right? What was going on there?
That is something that's kind of common with the honey locust, and it's a canker-type disease. And it can be initiated during handling when the tree is dug or delivered to its new home. So it can happen at that time before you even know it's really a problem. It could be something that happened while mowing the yard and somebody struck the base of the tree with a lawnmower or a string trimmer, or it just could be naturally occurring.
So what was Holly's course of action with this tree? What did she do when she first started noticing that this tree was having some problems and was in distress?
She got the professionals involved right away. Initially, she had a tree service offered deep root feeding, and that feeding was conducted. There was potentially a sign of improvement, but there was no sign of that in the photos or anything. And she also had an arborist do elevated work to remove large limbs that were up there. And then
limbs that had just died.
That had died off, that were a threat to the house, frankly, and to household life. And then the problem persisted, and another tree service was brought in. And this is a common scenario. They did not agree with the first tree service's approach. There are cons to deep root feeding. They didn't recommend that approach. And since that time, Holly has just basically been seeking out information and monitoring the tree's condition.
What are the problems with, briefly, what are the problems with deep root feeding? It sounds like a good idea.
You're
putting the food where the roots are.
That's right. And there are various opinions on this in arboriculture and in the green industry at the professional level. So I have of the opinion that the pressure has to be really just right based on the soil conditions, and that the probe does not need to go down very far. Most of the roots that take up the nutrients that the tree is missing, it can be approached from the surface with a drench and small pilot holes drilled, and then those pilot holes are filled with a plug or some kind of biochar or soil amendment.
What's the history of this tree for holly, and what's the history of this tree as it's been used in landscaping? Is it still a popular tree today?
The tree for holly was there when she moved into the home, and as she consulted with neighbors that had some knowledge of the time period that the house was built, they recalled that it was built in the 70s, and they also recalled that the tree was planted when the house was built. And I think that fits in nicely with some known facts about the honey locust. There were many, many of them planted at the time the house was built in the 70s when the house was built. Not sure how old the tree was when it was planted, but today it's somewhere between 50 and 60 years old. That is a kind of a common lifespan for the honey locust when it's planted in improved land. So improved land is a neighborhood where a subdivision has been cut out, a park, anything like that.
So I don't want to point a finger at holly, but is that the first thing she maybe should have looked at, is what is the lifespan of this tree in improved areas? And that would have given her a clue right there. It's like, well, how much time and effort am I going to put into this tree when it's already probably near the end of its life?
That's a good point to bring up, because perhaps that's something that could have been done with the initial consulting of an arborist. That's kind of something we've talked about here on Grow many times, is get all the facts, know thine enemy, right? Know what you're up against first before you start running into these services. But the services are there because somebody's trying to make a living. You just have to negotiate that corn maze a little bit.
Holly invested a lot of time and money into saving this tree. We talked a little bit about what's happened here, the deep root feeding, and going in and cleaning up the crown to make sure there aren't big branches that were going to fall on the house and hurt someone. What about treating that canker, that problem at the base of the tree? Is there any way to sort of treat that, fix that problem?
There is a way to treat it, and it's not a do-it-yourself project. It's something that a professional would have to use products that require a license to purchase. And spraying for canker, treating for canker, is also not a do-it-yourself step, and you got to catch it early. So there are a couple of large beech trees right out on the Arboretum Quad here at Illinois State that have canker. I don't think that the treatment would help save those trees, unfortunately. And I think that was the case. By the time that wound that's in the picture was visible, it's already starting to really put the pinch on the tree.
And the problem with that kind of infection at the base of the tree is it weakens the tree. You have a 70 or 80-foot tree here, and its foundation is crumbling.
At the most vulnerable point, and on top of that, they're known for failing right there, whether they're on improved land or in nature.
So there's some simple math to apply here when considering taking down a tree.
There is a good approach that one could take by just kind of, like I said, knowing what you're working with. And then Holly, in her due diligence, not only did she seek out the arborist, she sought out experts at the Fell Arboretum and the International Society of Arboriculture. The ISA has a worksheet that will help you kind of come up with a score to help one make a good judgment about whether the tree should be saved, or there's some kind of horticultural practice that could be employed, or to bring it down.
Ultimately, the risk to the house and safety was just too great. The cost to continue to try to save this tree, I would guess, was also too great. The decision was reached to remove the tree. What then?
So at that time, we offered Holly some right tree, right place alternatives to consider, because she asked, what should I plant upon cutting this tree down? So we did the right thing and kind of followed the Tree Campus USA guidelines for selecting these trees, and we gave her trees to consider in three areas. So those are lawn and yard trees, shade trees, 40 to 50 feet away from the house, large ornamentals, they would be somewhere that are at least 25 feet away from the house, and then the smallest ornamentals within 25 feet of the house. So now that that big tree's gone, Holly has lots of options.
Why not another honey locust?
We could run right into the exact same problem.
If you have questions about tree care or any gardening question, we might answer them on an upcoming episode of Grow. I'm Mike McCurdy with Patrick Murphy. Send your gardening questions to WGLT.org/grow.
You can also find the Grow podcast wherever you get your podcasts. You can also subscribe and find past episodes at WGLT.org. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Today's single Americans find fuel an over $2 billion online dating industry in search of love. Yet long before the first instant message or super like, people managed to find love, even if, or perhaps especially if, they weren't looking. GLT correspondent Brianna Groh has more from the Next to Normal Story Slam.
If you've ever been the lone single friend after everyone else is paired off, you've probably heard the cliche, you'll find love when you stop looking for it. Not only were Mike and Gail Dobbins not looking for love when they met nearly 45 years ago, they had also resolved to never be in love again.
Well, I had been divorced about 3 years when I met Mike, and he maybe a year and a half. That's just what we had in common to talk about because we didn't know anything else about each other. And we both had had nasty divorces and both had kids the same age, 6, 7, 8. And we had both decided on our own, the only way we could move forward out of that was to not hope for love again.
Gail worked full-time at a high-end retailer in Lincoln, Nebraska, where Mike taught at the University of Nebraska, and had just opened a new dinner theater in town. Gail was looking to earn some extra money, and Mike needed someone to play the lead in Neil Simon's Come Blow Your Horn. A coworker got Gail an audition for the part, and she decided to give it a shot.
So I go to the audition, and I can hear Anything Goes stomping around on stage in performance in the next room. And there stands the Tom Selleck-looking guy, that's Mike, with a script in his hand, and he says the best line ever. I know all the beautiful girls in Lincoln, Nebraska, but I don't know you. I say, I'm here to audition. I want to read for the part of Peggy. He says, no, no, you're perfect. You've got the role. You don't need to read. To which I say, I will read for this part. Sit down. Behind him, it's intermission, and 8 guys from Anything Goes are coming in to change their costumes down to their skivvies right behind him. I am trying to keep focus. I can't. I start laughing. He starts laughing. I take the part. I need the money.
Over the course of 17 rehearsals and 39 performances that season, Gail and Mike became close friends. It wasn't until one wintry evening they realized just how close they'd grown.
There was one special performance I remember. It was a blizzard. And he offered to drive me home. We were stopped at a red light on the intersection of Lincoln or of O Street and 17th in downtown Lincoln. And he leaned over and he kissed me ever so softly while Georgia played on the radio and the white flakes stuck to the windshield. What? My friend just kissed me. Ah, my director just kissed me. Silence all the way home.
It wasn't the last kiss they'd share. As winter gave way to spring and spring to summer, Gail fell in love, not only with Mike, but with his world of painted sets and spoken lines. But no love can remain untested. When Gail was offered her dream job in Shreveport, Louisiana, Mike got the call he was waiting for from Freeport, Illinois.
Shreveport to Freeport. That's 1,600 miles apart. But we loved being together. And so we would drive every other weekend to see each other, 800 miles each.
The arrangement worked just as long as their wallets and nerves could stand.
After Thanksgiving, he was driving me from Freeport to O'Hare to catch my plane to Shreveport. And we stopped at a little diner off of Interstate 80 to have a cup of coffee. And I fell apart. I said, "We can't go on this way. I'm tired. I'm broke. What are we going to do?" He said, "Well, we can see each other less." I said, "Yeah, yeah." He said, "We could call it off." I said, "Yeah, yeah." "We could get married." "Yeah, yeah." And he was jumping in the air in this restaurant, dancing around all of these tables and throwing his hat in the air, saying, "Yes, she said yes." And I thought, "Oh my God, did I?" We were married New Year's Eve, 1975, in Lincoln, all five of us. And the Godspell cast that we had left in Lincoln did our music for our wedding and our reception. While Mike and I washed all the dishes after the reception and took them back to the rental place. A moving van moved north from Shreveport to Freeport. Two happy kids were later adopted by this Tom Selleck guy that they adored. And life was good. No, it was wonderful. Thank you.
The duo shared their love of the stage and each other with the Heartland Theater Company for over 20 years, Gail as a member of the board of directors and Mike as managing artistic director. And when Mike died nearly 6 years ago, Gail says she stayed with Heartland to stay close to Mike.
"Because I loved theater and him, they were connected."
Gail says she decided to share her story with Next to Normal as a celebration of the marriage she never thought she would have.
"It wasn't hard at all. It was the discovery of what it's like to be married to someone that you really enjoy, who's great with your kids, who makes every day happy, cooking eggs and pancakes in the morning and dancing in the kitchen was normal for us, and then get the kids dancing too. And he sang all through the house, and we danced all the time. I know it sounds unbelievable, but this marriage was like that."
Gail Dobbins wasn't looking for another marriage when she found Mike. But, to quote another cliche, life is what happens while we're busy making other plans. I'm Brianna Groh.
This month's Next to Normal Story Slam takes place at 7:30 p.m. July 19th at the McLean County Arts Center in Bloomington. The theme of the night will be a road trip. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. David Lowery has been busy in the last few years. In addition to fronting the two rock bands he founded in the 90s, Cracker and Camper Van Beethoven, he now is a full professor at the University of Georgia. He teaches music business. GLT's John Norton caught up with Lowery at his home in Athens, Georgia, to talk about his busy schedule, which includes a stop at the Castle Theater in Bloomington Sunday night. He says his busy schedule isn't as difficult as you might think.
"I teach Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday, and then I basically leave town and I do my music stuff and catch up on grading homework and make lectures and stuff like that when we're flying or driving. I forget who said it was, Elvis Costello or somebody who said, I play for free, pay me to travel. Well, that's actually true. I mean, playing a show, a 90-minute show or a two-hour show, that's probably, you know, the smallest part of your day. You're often traveling or setting up or doing interviews or doing other things. Neither are really that difficult. And I don't teach in the summer, so I play in the summer. You know what I mean? I just kind of work around the two.
It's the mid-90s hit from Cracker. It's called Low. Band founder and frontman David Lowery joins us from his home in Athens, Georgia, where he's a full professor at the University of Georgia, and he teaches music business. He says he picked up his doctorate in education last year as well. Lowery says his professorship and picking up his doctorate in education last year came from being asked to give some guest lectures at various schools.
And then a class came open at University of Georgia, where I've worked with the director before, and he asked me if I'd teach that. So I taught one class. It was cool. And then the next year, they were like, hey, do you want to do this full time? And I was looking at my schedule. I was like, actually, I could do that. So I used my position as an instructor at University of Georgia to write a dissertation and get a doctorate. That costs money to do that.
Yeah, yeah.
In school for a doctorate. But if you're a professor there, you can take certain classes and do certain things like that. So I got a doctorate and wrote it mostly when I was on the road in the summer.
Did this all come out of then when you were really starting to become known nationally for your critique of, well, sort of the music business, I guess, would be the streaming part of the industry?
Yeah, I mean, it's just sort of the digital side of the business. Yeah, I mean, there's these ridiculous, antiquated federal consent decrees, and then for whatever reason the federal government sets the prices for which songwriters are compensated in the digital realm. I think they did that thinking they were jump starting the business, but now of course we're stuck with this structure. That basically started because I learned a lot more about copyright law and how the antitrust governance works and how that's really actually manipulated by the monopolies to underpay songwriters. I wrote about that. I testified to Congress. I did research, you know, on various platforms and such like that. So I had the knowledge just from having, like, run the business side of both my bands for, like, 30-something years. And, you know, I just sort of got a little better at it.
Yeah, we ain't got no government loans. No one sends a check from home to get this. We just do what we wanna. So let's get on this. Get on with it. If you wanna change the world, shut your mouth.
Get Off This is another 90s hit song for the band Cracker. Our guest is the band's founder and frontman, David Lowery, who has very pointed things to say about the business side of music. He even initiated a class action lawsuit against streaming giant Spotify that was to resolve claims that it published music without paying proper royalties to songwriters. Spotify has agreed to pay $43.45 million, though his name is no longer listed on the lawsuit. Another recent WGLT guest is music producer Steve Albini, who said earlier this year he understands the pointed critiques of the music business, but thinks the demise of major record companies has made for a much better environment for independent musicians. Lowery has another view. He believes the concentration of record companies gives them even more power.
Before, your gatekeepers were your major labels and stuff like that. Now, of course, you have the tyranny of choice, where if you look at most artists when they release stuff, because there is so much stuff out there now, you have to have publicists, promotion companies, record labels, somebody behind you promoting your stuff. I mean, occasionally something slipped through, but that was true in the old days. Camper Van Beethoven is an example of something slipped through. We made that record, our first record, for $400. We distributed it through independent record stores. We mailed it out to DJs. Some DJ on the BBC started playing it. But when you go from, like, having maybe a few hundred records a week to basically anybody and anyone, like, uploading hundreds of thousands of songs a month, I guess, onto these digital platforms of YouTube, Spotify and SoundCloud and stuff like that? How do you get anybody's attention?
I think that's the question, right?
I think it's actually, in a lot of ways, harder for young acts to break through now because of this tyranny of choice. It's more important than ever that you have a publicist. It's more important than ever that you have somebody marketing your stuff because there's so much stuff out there. And without the money from record sales, you can't subsidize your tours, right?
Right.
It breaks down the whole system. I mean, I don't know if you know this, but artists never really made money from tours. I mean, the top artists did, and it's largely true today. I mean, I look at this, you know, my wife is a concert promoter. You know, she puts on probably over 1,000 shows a year. And you look at the economics of what the bands are walking out with, and you just count the number of people there, add up the hotel rooms, look at the bus. You get, they didn't make any money on that show. So what the deal is, sure, you can go out there and play. You can go out there. You can put records out on the internet. You can go even go out and do some touring. You'll never make a living doing it unless you get in the top 1%. You know, look how many shows there are. And something like 60% of the revenue goes to the top 1% of touring bands.
We got oil fields in the Central Valley. We got cowboys out in the Mojave. Salinas Valley, yeah, where I come from. We got farms far as the eye can see.
That's California Country Boy. It's from Cracker's 2014 album, Berkeley to Bakersfield. It's a two-album critique and contrast of two parts of California, one being the area most people think about when California comes to mind. Places like Santa Monica, the Golden Gate Bridge, and Hollywood.
That's a very different California than the inland California in which I, you know, grew up, which is dustier, ranches, farms. You know, a lot of my family came out to basically pick fruit and work on farms in the Coachella Valley. And it's two very different Californias, and musically it's very different. Like, people don't realize this, but a lot of what, you know, we consider classic country music is actually the Bakersfield sound, and which is, you know, different than the Texas and Tennessee sound. It's a little more edgy, right? You have rock along the coast in California, and you have sort of country, sort of inland and Norteño as well, which is sort of the Mexican-American side of that experience. And I just wanted to sort of contrast and compare those two things because we have elements of both in Cracker, and I think that's what makes Cracker unique, is that we have the countryside and we have sort of the rock side, and then we bounce between them pretty effortlessly, I think. And we've done that since the first album.
Took a trip to California to see where those old days had gone.
From the album Berkeley to Bakersfield, our guest is David Lowery with the band Cracker. This is GLT Sound Ideas. Can't let you go without talking about Teen Angst. It's the first song that made you as Cracker out there, and first a lot of us got to know the band. But you got the great line in there, my all-time favorite line in the song. Until later, and I figured out that song, that's not really about critiquing folk music, that's about getting the girl.
Like all songs are. Actually, truthfully, that's borrowed from a narrative style that you see in country music all the time, the old third verse switcheroo, where you realize the song's about something else. That's a classic country narrative style, and that's actually what I'm borrowing from with that song. It's like I'm not giving it away till the third verse, just like Green Green Grass of Home. You realize third verse, of course, that it's actually quite a dark song, that the guy is about to be executed, right? But if you think through, like, sort of the country music catalog, that is kind of the standard way of putting a twist on a song, and that's exactly what I'm doing.
David Lowery of Cracker and Camper Van Beethoven speaking with GLT's John Norton. Cracker returns to the Castle Theater in Bloomington Sunday night. Discover other local music and hear from artists playing in Central Illinois on the GLT Music Podcast. Find it on NPR One or your favorite podcast app. Let's listen to a little more Cracker. Your attention. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal, made possible with listener contributions at WGLT.org. WGLT.org is also where you can find Sound Ideas interviews and stories with help today from John Norton, Mike McCurdy, Ryan Denham, and Brianna Grove. I'm Charlie Schlenker. You can subscribe to Sound Ideas on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, or NPR One. This is 89.1 and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's Public Media.